I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. Annie Leontis begins her debut novel, Let Me Explain You, with an email sent by Greek immigrant Stavros Mavrakis to his three daughters and ex-wife. He believes he has just 10 days to live and gives his family some unsolicited advice. Fix your hair, go to church, marry a man with a good mustache, and to his ex-wife, wear black for a year to honor me after I'm dead. The book explores their shifting relationship with this irascible patriarch and the angst of immigration. It's also about food and includes mouth-watering descriptions of Greek meals. Annie Leontis joins us on Radio Times here in our studio to tell us about writing this book, her family's own immigrant experiences, also working with youth in Philadelphia. She's an instructor and curriculum specialist at Philadelphia Futures. And Annie Leontis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your debut novel.
Thank you.
I'd love to have you begin at the very beginning of the book.
It starts as an email. From Steve Stavros Mavrakis, Greek Boss 1 at yahoo.com. To Chef Stevie Mavrakis at saltrestaurant.com, xxangelxx at yahoo.com, Ruby Mavrakis at yahoo.com, Carol M. at starbucks.com. Subject: Our father who was dying in 10 days. Dear family, daughters and ex-wife, let me explain you something. I'm sick in a way that no doctor would have much understanding. I'm sick in a way of the soul that, yes, God will take me. No, I am not a suicide. I am deeper than that. I am talking more than that. Dear Stavroula, my oldest, please grow out your hair. It is very, very short. This is one little thing that can change everything, you will see what I am saying, when you take this small but substantial advice. Sometimes, if we are who we are supposed to be on the outside, we are who we are supposed to be on the inside. The hair is the thing to trust and leave alone, and it will take care of you. Let me explain you something. Your father has seen some of the world for it to be enough. There is a way to be for the normal society, and you are not in it. The hair says things about you that, yes, they are true, but the hair is not a fortune teller. The hair is not the thing that has to point the way, like a street light. I am not somebody religious, but this I know. Death is coming. In 10 days, I promise you, your father, the man, will cease. He will be dust. He will be food in the worms. What do we owe our father? This is the question you can say to yourself at this time. Who can deny a dead man, a dead father, the thing that he demands? No, I am not sick like my brother in Crete, who die with emphysema. This is Greek en, which means in, and phaizon, which means breath.
And that's our guest, Annie Leontis, reading from the very beginning of her debut novel called Let Me Explain You. So why does Stavros think he is dying?
Well, Stavros is the sort of man that believes he can have prophetic dreams. And he's in a very tough place in his life. He's sort of mourning the end of his marriage. He feels jilted by his daughters. And this dream comes to him in the form of a goat, this prophecy. And he interprets that it means he will die in 10 days once the goat sort of pounds on the dirt 10 times. And he tries to shake the dream off. But then at his diner, at his establishment, a real diner, a real goat walks up to him and happens to be eating only his brand of cigarettes, which are Saratogas, which nobody smokes. I mean, I don't even think I've seen them in the world. but this goat is only chewing his brand of cigarettes, and Stavros takes that as a sign.
Well, I scribbled next to that, yeah, he's such a drama king,
right?
Yeah. And boy, is he laying on the guilt there, too,
yeah.
Right?
The guilt, the obligation, the expectation, yeah.
Is there something about goat dreams in Greek families? Does that mean something?
Not that I know of. You know, there's a fabled Cretan goat, the Cri-Cri, which is a very elusive creature. And I think it sort of comes down also from mythology, but nothing that sort of in modern tales I would have been given. It just was something that became an anchor and a catalyst for him and is a little bit of his alter. I feel like it's a little bit of his alter.
Interesting. Well, I read that this story began with him, right? And actually began with him believing or saying that he's going to die.
Yes.
That was the kind of germ for this story?
Yeah, I didn't get his voice immediately. It actually took a little while to understand the humor and the levity. But certainly the gravity came first, and this very large announcement of his impending death. I didn't know why he was dying. I didn't know if he was dying. But I knew that this was a man having a crisis of sorts who wants his family to understand that. And this is sort of writ large of what that means for him.
Well, and some of the reviewers said, you know, this is a guy with women problems because he's essentially surrounded by women, his three daughters, a couple of ex-wives, a girlfriend. His manager is also a woman as well. So
yes, he's drowning in women.
He's drowning in women. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell whether he likes it or whether it's just driving him batty.
Well, that's a great question. I think he's come from a family.
He likes women, doesn't he?
He likes women, but he's very much a patriarch and believes that women should, you know, exist in certain spaces and have certain identities and behave. There is a sort of resistance to any kind of feminism. You know, he believes that the women in his life are really instruments of him. And I think it's hard for him. He's come from a family of men. You know, he's one of 12 brothers, and he, instead of having sons, has had daughters. So I think in some ways he's always trying to make up for that.
In this email, the one you read goes to Stavrola. She's 31 years old. She works in a restaurant, so she's sort of part of this, restaurant family. But he talks about normal society. Mm-hmm. He's telling her something. He's talking about her hair, but he's telling her something else.
Yeah, and that was a very interesting moment because he couldn't quite call her out because I don't even think he knows how to resist or complain or object to what it is she is, because she herself hasn't even quite become what she needs to be. But he believes very much in sort of a superficial communication of your identity, and long hair would suggest something about this woman that short hair wouldn't. And so it's the one thing he's able to latch onto, that maybe if I could just get her to grow out her hair, she'll be a different kind of woman. You know, she won't love women.
Well, exactly, because she's in love or infatuated with the daughter of Stavros's partner.
Well, she's actually in love with her own boss's daughter.
Her own boss. That's right. Right. So, but she's not sure, right? I mean, she feels these urgings, but she feels like a 15-year-old.
She does feel like a 15-year-old. She has not allowed herself to explore this part of her because there have been so many messages, and not just from her father, from her mentor Marina as well, that have made this completely unavailable to her. And so in some ways her own growth has been stunted. And this letter comes as a kind of catalyst for her. Right. You know, this is the time. This is the time to reach out if she's going to. And I think as she develops in the book, you know, one of the ways that she tries to woo this woman that she's in love with and has been in love with for a couple of years now is to build a menu completely dedicated to this woman.
Right.
You know,
July. Right?
Yeah, this woman, July. Every menu on every item on the menu is dedicated to July, inspired by July. You know, there's July's July, which is a dish of blackberries and feta with some pickled onion. You know, everything is really in service of this. And I think that makes it very real for her, you know, the fact that she is creating something that is a demonstration of her feelings proves to her that these feelings are real, even if they aren't going to be reciprocated.
Are you a good cook? I mean, reading this, I felt like this woman knows how to cook.
I'm just okay, to be honest.
Really? Are you a good eater then?
I'm a wonderful eater, yes. It's one of my favorite pastimes. I love food. I love reading about food. I love smelling food. I love grocery shopping. People hate that. But, I have very limited training. Funny enough, I worked for an evangelical coffee house called the Grace Place in Ocean City when I was in college, and I got some basic training there, how to hold a knife kind of thing. I watch a lot of Food Network when I'm running. You know, my sister, she herself went to culinary school, so I've been able to pick up some great tips from her. But I'm just okay, to be honest. You can fake a lot on the page.
Well, indeed, because I have to say that as I was reading things, I thought, wow, I would love to eat something like that. But there are all these references. I ate the whole world to find you. At one point, Stavros is looking into his girlfriend's mouth, surprised by her teeth, the space between them, the way he felt he could fit his whole body inside. I mean, it seems like something about the mouth, about eating, it seems so oral.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, there's a great tradition of obviously food in Greek culture and meals that last hours and hours, meals that begin very late, you know, dinner, 10 o'clock dinners, you know, so there's a very, you know, it's a very passionate culture. And I think one of the ways that that comes through is in its food. And, and even when, you know, like I'm 1.5 generation, I guess, and I've lost a lot. I've lost the language and my sister dances, but I don't dance, you know. And but the food, I've been able to hold on to that as an artifact, and even a commodity. So that's something I carry with me, and I feel like is probably maybe why this book, as a Greek book, might speak to non-Greeks, you know.
Well, and also about immigration, people who must carry everything they own in their own mouths, all of their luggage, they squeeze into their mouth. They can only fit so much of the old place. I mean, the idea of bringing that past, that country with you when you come as a newcomer to this country.
Yeah, that, you know, you've sort of struck the, for me, what the great heart of the book is, those lines. Marina says them later in the book, and that feels
she's very, the partner of Stavros.
Yeah. So she's sort of his co-conspirator and partner chef. She, for me, embodies the immigrant experience. You know, when I'm writing her and remembering my own assimilation, she's a way that I can sort of safely deposit that dislocation, which I think is true of the immigrant experience. And I think it impacts multiple generations, not just the immigrating generation. And so in that way, I'm hoping that, that this book transcends, you know, Greek culture as well.
She says, or so many people, or so much soup before you must spit and take a breath, and then a very different world fills you up. It's not unwelcome. It's just reinvention, this immigration, even after so many years later.
Yeah. And I think Salman Rushdie says, talks about immigration as a reinvention as well. And that's that, you know, reinvention is some of the most difficult creative work we do in the world. Artists, writers, thinkers, politicians, you know, and these people are doing it in their daily lives, day after day.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Annie Leontis. She is a novelist now. She's just written her first novel. It's called Let Me Explain You. And she read a section from that book. After this short break, I'll have her read another section as well. And spent some of her early childhood in Greece, lives in the Philadelphia area. She's also an instructor and curriculum specialist at Philadelphia Futures. And we'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation. If you want to join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Annie Leontis about her debut novel, Let Me Explain You. And again, it's about a Greek immigrant patriarch, a man named Stavros Mivrakis. And he's had a premonition that he only has 10 days to live. He sends an email to his ex-wife, to his three daughters, and telling them essentially how they should live their lives. And I want to have Annie Leontis read another section from the book. And this is where Stavros is writing a letter to God.
Dear God, it is me, Stavros Mavrakis. Do you know, all these times, I have been writing love letters to my daughters, my wives? No one understands that the entire life of Stavros is a love letter with no possible translation. So it is to you, God, I write my final letter, which this is a letter of heartbreak. And I hope that you answer with mercy, which, when you think down to it, is what love really is. Did you realize all these times I address to you in English? But I think it is the only way, God, you will listen. Greek is the language of my beginning, and English the language of my end. Two lives, two languages. Also, God, you see how much I am improving with my writing. A man spends his whole life trying to say it better. An egg, you remember, because you created it, is the smallest of all living matters. It can understand only its small, warm self. The egg cannot see, only feel. Inside the shell, the heartbeat is the constant belief. There is a truth in this. In the history of the world, it is eggs that have changed everything. Why could I not be this egg, God? Why do you have to crack Stavros Stavros Mavrakis? I have seen you make scramble of the lives of Litsa and also her mother Dina. For Marina, for Stavrula, you boil life until the wet egg is becoming not egg, but almost meat. Then there are eggs that are laid by golden geese like Ruby, Hero, like men who are famous and rich. How is this fair and equal, God, to give for some? My ex-wife, she is the rotten egg. But for Stavros Stavros Mavrakis, you have made me over hard. The chef does not care that I have been cooking too long. You, the chef, hold me to the pan. You, the chef, ruin me because a man, like an egg, cannot be changed back to what he once was or what he was never meant to be. Once an egg is cooked, it cannot be forgiven. Some may call my letters the letters of a suicide or a crazy man, or some even the prophet. And maybe those are the fates of Stavros Stavros Mavrakis. But here is the actual truth. Stavros Stavros has cooked himself. He is a weak man. I can confess this to you, God. I feel the broken in me, the white parts of me so cook they are almost fry. I could be better, and want to be, but my whole life I am too afraid to be something special, like omelet or cake. I think being an egg means I can be only yolk. I wish to go differently in death. Dear God, make the life of Stavros Stavros Mavrakis over easy.
I love that letter that he writes to God. Again,
Thank you.
Our guest, Annie Leontis, reading from her novel, Let Me Explain You. There's so much in here. And as a reader, this is when I began to really understand Stavros Stavros Mavrakis, as he refers to himself in the third person in this letter to God. But I understood, I think, more about his heart.
I did, too, in writing this letter. You know, that's the challenge of writing a patriarch like this, someone who, in the beginning, I think I wanted to expose.
Were you mad at him?
I was very mad at him. I wanted to sort of say, you know, there's an inheritance that is given to daughters of a narcissistic, overbearing patriarch. I've talked to a lot of young women, actually, readers, and young men who sort of feel the same way. And so in the beginning, I wanted to expel that frustration. But you can't be a writer and not have empathy for all of your characters. They die quickly on the page, or they just are never born. And so I had to constantly understand Stavros. And one of the ways was through his voice, through humor, and understanding that humor for Stavros doesn't mean kicking him while he's down, but empathizing a bit with the ridiculousness of his life and maybe his perspective, and then getting to this letter, which really is, for me, probably the deepest thing, the deepest revelation of Stavros. You know, and any time a person is in communion with God, you know, there's a definite respect that needs to be conceived. And so I think when I realized he had to write to God, I understood I was going to get closer to him than I had been.
I love him. I mean, he can't stay away from making some jokes. My ex-wife, she's the rotten egg. A dear God, make the life of Stavros Stavros Mavrakis over easy, right? You know, just the fried egg, I guess. I thought it was interesting where he says, you know, Greek is the language of my beginning and English the language of my end. And like many immigrants coming to this country, in this case, from Greece or from Crete, where he was born, living in two worlds of language, and even the title of the book, Let Me Explain You. Was that a phrase you grew up hearing?
It was, yes. My father would say, let me explain you something, you know. And it would be infuriating, not because of, like, the grammatical construction, but because it it suggested a kind of power dynamic that I was never going to overcome. So let me explain. You ended up being it sort of once I wrote that, once I got the title, I knew that I actually was finished the book because I understood there are a lot of ways to read that title onto the book. You know, and a lot of characters in the book try to claim that phrase. I mean, he says it. He says he opens up saying it, but then the daughters take it back. Let we explain you something. Because that kind of explanation isn't there's not a one way to do that.
There are three daughters in this book. Are they sort of all a piece of you? I mean, one is the older daughter. The middle daughter actually got married for a week and has a 19-year-old boyfriend. That's Litsa, and then the youngest one as well seems to be the father's favorite. I mean, that's the way he addresses her. Mm-hmm. Are there pieces of you in all those girls?
Yeah, I think when you're writing characters, there sort of have to be pieces of you in all of them, but particularly the daughters. Stavrula is very independent. She uses food, I think, in the way that I might use words and writing. Litsa is at a point in her life. She's also very, very resilient, which I think that I am as well. But she's also, for me, a very safe place to put rage and anger.
Yeah, she does get it. She breaks things.
She breaks things. You know how she feels at all times. So as opposed to, lashing out at the people I love, there's Litsa there for that.
Right.
And Ruby, too, who is still seeking, trying to find herself in the world. So I think there are definitely pieces of me in all of them. Otherwise, I don't know that I'd be able to build them. And the same with Stavros, there are things certainly in that character that I couldn't have built without having some sympathies.
You've never written a novel before.
Well,
is this hard? I mean, you write, but this is, what, a 300-some-page novel?
Yes. I mean, I wrote one in my 20s that thankfully didn't go anywhere.
Is it buried somewhere in
buried,
a drawer?
Buried, just in the ground, just 6 feet
completely
deep.
Completely gone. Okay.
And that was fine. It was, where I got my chops, and I understood how not to write a novel. And, with this novel, I understood that you have to be vulnerable as a writer. You have to open up some vulnerabilities in yourself and in the characters. You can't be on the outside looking in. And understanding some things about structure and tension, for instance, when I was writing this book, initially, part of the plot, the early plot, is that he goes missing before the 10 days are up.
Right.
In the first draft, he actually went missing like 50 pages from the end. And that's an incredible revision once you realize actually he needs to disappear 100 pages in. As opposed to 50 pages out.
Is that because you understood him better? You understood, at that point you understood what the story actually was about?
That's right. Yeah, you get to the end and you're like, oh, this is what I'm trying to build. And then you go and, I kind of equate it to I've built a mountain, but I've built it in the wrong place. So now I have to move it. That's what revision felt like.
Is that painful?
Yes, painful. It's very painful, but it's also liberating once you have this much material. You kill your darlings. Everything has to be in service of the, the ending, the raison d'être. So I just, I felt like at least getting to the ending showed me what I could get away with and what I had to get rid of.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Annie Leontis, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She's written her first novel. It's a book called Let Me Explain You. She's been doing some reading from the book so you can have a sense of what the story is about. You can call us to join the conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. There's several words in here, some of which I will not pronounce on the air. I'll let you do that for me. But there's one having to do with exile and loss, Zenitia.
Zenitia, yeah.
Xenitia, mm-hmm. A Greek word.
It is. It's a Greek word. This is going to be comical, but it actually comes from the word xenos, which means stranger in Greek. And it is a... It's a Greek concept, but I believe it's universal for all immigrants, all immigrant experience. And that is it's a profound dislocation that results It's sort of a feeling of exile that results as a result of immigration. You know, you've left your home, you've left your family, you've left likely village life. And it has its roots, I think, in 15th century Greek poets. There's songs to Zenitia, there's a lot of conversation now about it as well, because so many Greeks are leaving Greece as a result of the state of the economy. And so it's sort of having this reemergence. And I had learned about it maybe in my early 20s and kind of forgotten about it, and came back to it when I was finalizing this book and understood that it's actually conceptually a really great frame for what these characters, all of them, are experiencing.
Well, and one of the characters says, "You are suffering because you forget who you are." I mean, that seems like that's what's at the core of Zenitia, is you forget who you, perhaps who you were, but maybe perhaps who you are.
Yeah, you forget who you are, or you are you're longing for something that no longer is. You know, you're part of assimilation is adapting to a new home and saying, this is my new life, you know, this is my new place. And I think those who suffer more and most in Zenitia have not quite been able to see themselves having a new life. They're mourning for the past one.
Let me read an email from Judith. She says, this is truly one of the best novels I've read in a very long time because it shows how funny and sad family relationships are. The love for all the characters really bounce off the page, as does the wonderful language. When you began thinking about writing this, although obviously there are autobiographical elements, were you also thinking of King Lear and his three daughters? How does Stavros resemble or not resemble the doomed king?
You know, there's something really funny, which is I wasn't consciously thinking about King Lear. And I think that was probably a blessing, because how do you start your first novel?
How are you going to top that, right?
So, it was my advisor sort of said, oh, this is a very funny King Lear. And I was like, oh, well, that's an incredible compliment. But I did look for other models in literature once, especially I understood the scope of Stavros' character. Carlos Fuentes, The Death of Artemio Cruz, was a novel that figured largely for me. He's a writer from El Boom, and he writes a patriarch on his deathbed who's estranged from his daughter and wife. Mm-hmm. And so there are actually quite a few powerful patriarchal figures, through literature that I was able to draw from. Another book that is beloved to me, The Hakawadi by Rabi al-Madin, who is, this son is coming back to his father at his deathbed. And that, The Hakawadi, is story about storytellers. And so that's something, in fact, The Hakawadi begins something with, let me tell you a story. And I think there must have been an echo.
The email becomes the story?
Yeah.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah. Fascinating. Well, I'd love to have you read one more section from the book. And this is a very luscious description of something. Again, I will not say this. I will let you say this. Mm-hmm. But describe what it is that we're going to hear.
Okay, so this is about Stavros' first taste of galaktoboriko, which is a Greek dessert. He has the first taste in America. He's at a really hard place. He's jobless. His wife is abusing drugs. He is, the American dream is failing him at this moment. He doesn't know what he's going to do, and so he goes out to have a giant pancake, a giant American pancake for breakfast, can barely afford that, and then he sees this galaktoboriko sitting there and decides he needs to have it, no matter whether or not he can pay for it. So I'll just read when
he
takes the first
great.
Bite. The first bite was not too sweet, and it made him cry. He did not expect it. He could not help it. The galaktoboriko tasted like his mother's fingers. It smelled like her apron. It was exactly like the galaktoboriko she used to make. It was the twin of her galaktoboriko, and it made him wish for home. It made him want to burrow his head into his mother's thigh like he did when he was a small boy, to make the bucking sounds of a ram until she relented and threw her arms around him and smeared butter on his neck, and snuck him a little taste with her own fingers in a way that her other sons could not see. It gave him back memories he did not know he had. Any minute he expected his brothers to come and fight him for the prize. Any minute he expected the papas to join him and steal precious forkfuls of the dessert only so that he could turn around and order them another. But no, Stavros was alone. He was in a booth in Zenitia, in a country where Gallic de Bordico was nothing more than syllables and cream.
I love that section. And it's, first of all, smells and memory are so powerful. I mean, when he says it tasted like his mother's fingers, it smelled like her apron. Mm-hmm. I mean, there he was. He was a little boy again, mm-hmm. tasting this amazing. What is it, a pancake or it's a?
Well, this is, it's more, it's a, there's a, it's a semolina and it's like cream based inside mm-hmm. a phyllo dough with a syrup, like a rose syrup honey. Oh. It's wonderful.
I bet it sounds wonderful.
It's great.
But one also senses that sadness. I mean, for immigrants, they come, you know, wanting a better life, but they have to leave so much behind.
I think that's true. And I think, you know, Stavros would not want us to see him in this moment. You know, he would want to shelter himself and shelter us from seeing this. But it's truest to his experience, I think. And, you know, right after this moment, actually what happens is Hero, the proprietor of this diner, sits down and shares a slice with him
right.
and ultimately gives him a job. And so there is a rebuilding that happens. But certainly this is a moment for sadness and yeah. isolation. You know, he's out creating a new life without family. That's a very, very hard thing for anybody to do.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Annie Leontis today on Radio Times. Again, she's written a novel. It's her very first. It's called Let Me Explain You. And lives here in the Philadelphia area. In fact, is an instructor and curriculum specialist at Philadelphia Futures, working with young people in this city. I should also add that she co-hosts the Tire Fire reading series in Philadelphia. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And after this short break, I'll talk more about Annie Leontis's actual life, not her fictional life in her characters. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Annie Leontis about writing her new novel, Let Me Explain You. And I do want to talk a little bit about how her family came to the U.S., how she got here as well. She spent a fair amount of time as a teacher, worked as a substitute, working with young people as well. A tweet from, I should say, Aunt Judy. It's nice to have family that
Indeed.
Loves you. I read the book in one day, one of the greatest books I've ever read. Congratulations. You are a writer. That's from your Aunt Judy.
Yes.
So you were actually born. So, and one thing, you were interviewed on NPR on All Things Considered. So your parents were in an arranged marriage, rather like Stavros's marriage.
They were
his
yes.
first marriage.
Yeah, which was falling out of the favor at the time, I think. But they were in an arranged marriage. The biographical, the sketch in the, you know, the early sketch is quite similar to mine. My biological mother did struggle with substance abuse. We did, as a result, go back to Greece. So I was raised by extended family mm-hmm. there. As
you and your siblings?
My sister and I were raised there. And then we did come back at 5, 6-ish right. years old. And I remember very vividly my first day in the States.
So what was that first day like?
Did
you speak any English whatsoever?
Well, I knew how to say the word yes, and I very badly wanted to say it, but I was too afraid. And my father was asking me in Greek, are you hungry? And I wanted to say yes, but I was so overwhelmed by, like, my giant new adoptive family. I also, for a long time, couldn't say the word hungry. I would say hungily.
Oh.
And so so my cousin would say, what are you? I'm hungily. What are you? I'm hungily. So there were, you know, I remember those early days. And I think, you know, and growing up, my nickname was like Little Foreigner. So this is something that.
Oh, is that what the family calls you?
Yeah. They were like, oh, Little Foreigner. I think I came over and I looked like a little old lady or something.
Were you dressed differently than?
Yeah.
Like a little postcard or something?
And my, you know, my name is Anna. And so they were like, oh, that's too serious. We're going to change it to Annie. So there was a lot. There are many kinds of assimilation that happened early on.
Do five-year-olds have Janisha?
You know, I think they do. I think I do on some level. It's a strange experience. I'm sort of in this interstitial space. I mean, I'm very Americanized. As I mentioned, I've lost most of my Greek and had to relearn as an adult the parts that I have retained. But, you know, there's a sense of loss and dislocation and a very visceral sense of feeling foreign that I carry with me and that probably has been the reason I'm a writer.
Because you're kind of outside looking in.
Right. Yeah. And always being very aware of adapting and assimilating and having multiple lives. I've had very, very different lives. Every few years I sort of, you know, shed a skin and start.
Is that right?
In some ways, yeah. You know, depending on what's going on. But and I just think that at the heart of it, I probably do have that sense of dislocation or else I wouldn't have been able to write this book.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Savrola, the oldest daughter, I mean, she is gay. She has to sort of recognize that. Within Greek families, is that considered, you know, a shame or a problem to be dealt with? I mean, I think all families deal with it differently, but is there something different in Greek families?
Yeah, well, it's so dominantly patriarchal.
Even now?
I mean, I think it's changing. It depends on where you are and, you know, whether you're talking about family in Greece. I haven't been able to bring my wife back. We can't really.
You can't do that?
I can't really do that, which is, it saddens me quite a bit.
Were you told not to, or are you just sort of reading the tea leaves, so to speak?
It's probably a little bit of both. You know, my father struggles with this, and as a result, we have a very strained relationship.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that's actually part of why I needed to write this book too. And you know, growing up in just a homogenous community in the 80s, being gay was not okay. And so that's another sense of foreignness that I experienced. And it took me a long time to come to terms with my identity.
I mean, like Stavrola,
like
in
Like Stavrola,
way.
Yeah. So, and I wanted to, you know, she's, I'm far more along than she is.
Well, you're married, for one
I'm
thing.
I'm married. The legalization helped. No, but really, it did, you know, it took me a little while. And it also, there are just certain messages that you hold on to, even if they're implicit. But certainly, they were explicit as well.
So is this letter, I mean, excuse me, is this book a kind of letter to your father?
I think it's honestly a letter to myself, to give me permission for certain experiences and feelings. And I think it's a letter even more to the women in my family who have demonstrated resiliency and different ways of existing, demanding their own lives and their own existence.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me, because Stavros is, I mean, I have to say I had a great deal of affection for him by the end of the book, and I think you do as well. And I always look at acknowledgments, and you acknowledge your mom and your sisters, but you didn't acknowledge your dad.
Mm. Yeah, that's complicated.
I'm
that's
sure
a complicated
it is,
story.
But I made a little note to myself, not thank dad.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the book is, I think, acknowledging him and probably the range of his experiences. Mm-hmm. But I think acknowledgments are a place where you sort of say that you want to thank people for their support of a particular project. And so that was important for me to do. You know, this is a book about women. I mean, I go on to thank my little cousin, Marissa, who taught me about what it means to be resilient in childhood. So there are plenty of men I could thank in addition to my father. But they, you know, for me, this book it ends up being a book for these women.
Has your dad read it? Do you know?
You know, I'm not sure, but I think he's read enough to I've heard that he agrees with some of what Stavros says. So,
well, he is very persuasive.
He is. He's very charming. I was actually thinking.
He is kind of charming.
He's very charming. Yeah, I was thinking about your show, your guest last week, Jeffrey Kluger, who wrote The Narcissist Next Door, and how narcissists are very charming. And it's very true of Stavros. You know, he takes up a lot of oxygen, And I've had readers, early readers say, why don't you make the whole book in his voice? And it's not, I mean, it's not a bad idea. He is very powerful in the page. And at the end of the day, it's about, you know, whose voice gets to be heard. And for me, they all have to be heard, his included.
You mentioned the Greek crisis. Do you feel any connection to what's going on in Greece? I mean, it is pretty scary to watch what's going on there and to be also confused by a lot of the decision making. But clearly people are leaving the country. Do you worry for Greece?
I do. I mean, I have a lot of extended family. I mean, my entire family is there. And so, you know, it's been many years now. They can't get work or enough work. I have cousins who have left. One of my cousins is now in Dubai. Another one goes frequently to Thailand. You know, one thing that I feel confident in is Greek people are very resilient after like a history of being occupied. You know, when they were occupied by the Nazis, they took to the mountains and, you know, fought invaders. They resisted, you know, for hundreds of years at this point. And so that's something that's comforting, even if this is terrifying. I was reading an article recently that said heating oil the tax is up by 450%. I mean, we're talking just such difficult obstacles to overcome. So I do worry, but I have hope.
Yeah. Did you write as a kid? I mean, were you a little girl that wrote stories?
I did. I did it privately. I think in my family, you know, work meant a certain. You know, I'm first generation of college, and I'm you know, my understanding of work as an immigrant was you become a professional, you know, be a lawyer, you know, or an educator in my case. And so writing still in some ways feels like a luxury, and I have to overcome that every time I sit down to write, to say, you know, why aren't I teaching full time in public schools, for instance, you know, and helping young people full time.
Because does it feel indulgent?
It does. It does.
Really?
As hard as it is, as difficult as this work is, it feels very indulgent and like something I have to constantly earn, which is not a bad thing. I mean, it makes you disciplined, and it makes you treat it, you know, seriously, like something that, you know, it's not just a given. But it is hard to convince myself of that every day.
Well, you were a teacher for a while. You taught in the was it the Newark school system?
I did. Yeah,
Newark,
I taught
New Jersey.
At Beringer High School in Newark for 5 years. I've worked with the National Writing Project at Rutgers since 2007, teaching teachers how to teach writing. I am currently working with Philadelphia Futures as an instructor and a curriculum specialist, and that's really wonderful, actually, because it feels like high impact in a way that still allows me to write, because, you know, both of these are vocations and callings, but they demand the same kind of energy, grit, creativity, and, you know, you only, as much as I want to have multiple lives, you only do, do have one life.
Do you miss teaching at all? Did you like teaching high school, and did you like working with the kids,
high
schoolers?
It's so fun. You know, they keep you young, and
they do.
You know, they're
on your toes.
There's
right?
no filter. They're the funniest people on the planet, and they're very, very creative. And I mean, talk about reinvention. You know, that's where that's happening. You know,
that's what adolescence is.
It really is. It really is. You know, and they're inheriting a world that they're going to continue to reinvent and reimagine. And I have just utmost respect for that. And so I love working with my students at Philadelphia Futures. We've got just, you know, it's a college success program, and we work with low-income first-generation students. And we work with them through high school and college to ensure completion. And those students are just doing incredibly well.
And you're a first-generation college graduate, right?
I am.
In your family?
Yes, yes. And that feels like a kind of foreignness, too, in the writing world. And I, you know, it's a different kind of life experience than my entire family. I mean, my family members, they all work very hard. My father's a welder, not a diner owner. My sisters and my mother are in retail and management. You know, and they have a great business sense, and they have great ideas for how I can pitch the book, you know, and market the book.
And they call into talk shows, right?
right. So, but you know, being a writer is a, it's a very, and I'm sort of spoiled by that. Like, they're very excited about it, you know?
But was there, were you the one to go to college, or what? I mean, were you the kind of designated college attendee or whatever?
Yeah. Yes. I had always been talked to about college. You know, immigrant families, they often implore their children to go to school and have a better life than they had. And I took that, I mean, I heard that message so much growing up, and it made a lot of sense. But of course, being in college and then coming home, there's a break in the experience.
Right. Does it feel lonely? Or just that somehow you've had a different kind of experience, or perhaps on a different kind of track?
Yeah, there's a bit of a culture shock. There's a bit of like, how do you come? I mean, our students at Philadelphia Futures are sort of dealing with the same question. You know, how do you come home? How can you be in both worlds? You know, this, again, interstitial space. Mm-hmm. I'm constantly feeling like I have to catch up because there's sort of like an inheritance of culture that many of my colleagues who are writers or intellectuals have. They grew up with literature, books. There's just a great framework in place that allows for artistic apprenticeship early. And I had that in different ways. You know, I don't want to bemoan my experience because I think it was very rich and it gave me a lot. But in some ways, I'm still catching up.
Yeah. I read you were a substitute teacher for a while, and I think within the teaching profession, that may be the hardest job.
Oh, my God, yes.
I mean, because I remember how horrible I was to substitute teachers, and I was, like, not a bad kid. Mm-hmm. I was kind of mischievous, but I would, you know, we saw a substitute walk in the door. We were going to get them.
Oh, totally. I mean, that's where you get your chops, you know. I was good at my job because I had substitute taught, and not just like, here's a classroom for 3 weeks. Every single day, a revolving door, a new batch of
students. You
get a call in the morning. You show up. Plainfield High School.
That seems scary to me.
Well, you know, I mean, it's funny you say that because students know, you know, teenagers know they can smell fear.
So would you kind of?
Yeah. Well, I'm 4'11", so you know you.
I do want to say that, but yes.
You know, you have to, and I'm not afraid of. Some people are afraid of teenagers. I'm not afraid of them. I think that you find a way to relate. You learn their names very quickly. I would always have kind of like a bag of tricks and but things that were literature too, and maybe the kinds of moving stories or pieces of art that they might not necessarily encounter daily in their classrooms. So I found a way to connect, and it sharpened some tools and resources for me.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. And I also have one more question for you. Are you working on another book, another novel? Do you feel like, or sometimes novelists talk about something working on them?
Yeah, I think something that this book didn't allow enough of. It does a little bit, but it didn't allow me to play imaginatively with like surrealist elements. And so I'm sort of working on some short fiction right now that allows for that kind of room. They're sort of short politicized pieces. It's very nascent, you know, early stages. But I think probably as a writer, my strength is reinvention. So I'm going to try to do something completely different.
And do you write every day? Do you sit yourself down and make sure you write something every day?
I don't. I beat myself up about that for a long time. And then I started to literally diagram every time I wrote what the conditions were and why. And I started to understand it was cyclical for me.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're welcome. Annie Leontes, her book is called Let Me Explain You. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane and Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. Thank you so much for joining us.